Good morning. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by the volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Diane, and I will be reading from the Sun today. I'm reading solo. Richard is not here. And Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their continued support. Okay, first out, headline news, which is kind of sad. Body found in canal is missing Chelmsford resident. He was caring, loving person. Family friends remember 22-year-old Gavin Saab. Lowell. The family of Gavin Saab, the 22-year-old Chelmsford man reported missing earlier this week, confirmed that the body recovered from Lowell's Western Canal on Thursday is Gavin. He was a caring, loving person who will be missed greatly by us, his mother, Sarah Saab, told the Sun hours after the discovery. His brother, Aiden, added that Gavin always made me feel happy and loved. Gavin, a 2021 graduate of Neshoba Valley Technical High School in Westford, has been missing since Monday, the Chelmsford police said in a Facebook post seeking the public's help that Gavin was last seen at about 5 p.m. in the area of Appleton Street in Lowell. On Thursday evening, the department updated the post, saying the search for Gavin had concluded. We are extend our thoughts to the family and respectfully ask that their privacy be honored during this difficult time, the post stated. The discovery of a body in the Western Canal was first reported over an emergency radio broadcast at about 11:40 a.m. Thursday. A man calling 911 from the area of Fletcher and Suffolk Streets told dispatchers he was conducting a water study when he spotted a body in the water. Several minutes after that initial call, the Lowell Fire Department confirmed the report over the air and saw crews were launching a boat into the canal to carry out a recovery. In the afternoon, after the recovery had concluded, several people who live on Suffolk Street or gather on the walking path along the Western Canal pointed out the area where firefighters launched their boat. The path sits directly beside the canal, separated by a fence. As of Thursday evening, no official statements have been released by the authorities regarding the discovery. Maria and the family does not know how Gavin ended up in the water. She added, authorities told her that an autopsy is expected to take place on Friday. Several of Gavin's close friends gathered on Thursday evening to remember him. Nicholas Giannino, one of Gavin's close friends, said in a statement to the Sun that the group has come together to reflect on Gavin, noting that the gathering started sad, but now we are all smiling. I think that is a great encapsulation of what he brought into this world, Giannino said. He is far from perfect, and I wouldn't want the world to think he was, but he brought the most imperfect happiness into the world. He laughed when no one else could, drank when everyone else was done, and stood by even when the odds never really were on his side. Our friend group was held together by humor, and he was always at its core. Another friend, Andrew, described Gavin as the realest man I know. I wish he knew now how much we loved him, he said. Giannino added that Gavin was a traveler who never stopped anywhere for too long. I don't know how it happened, he said, referring to Gavin's death, but as a friend group in such an explicit or expletive world, we have been prepared for this day for someone now, later, and forever. Next article. Health insurance regulators okay steep premium increases. Out of Boston, nearly 700,000 Bay Staters will see double-digit premium increases next year, even after state insurance regulators managed to trim down rates across seven carriers and rejected the sharpest proposed spike of almost 26%. The Division of Insurance posted finalized rates Wednesday for the merged market where many individuals and small businesses get coverage. That translated into an average premium jump of 10.4%. In May, insurers unveiled proposed rates that would have led to an average increase of 12.9%. Insurance regulators rejected Fallon Community Health Plan's proposed 25.7% increase, deeming it excessive. Governor Maura Healey's office and the insurer can now choose to pursue an administrative appeal process, the plan that has 29,641 enrollees. Fallon Health spokesperson Melissa Randall said the insurer respects the division's decision and looks forward to continuing our discussions with them as the review process moves forward. As a not-for-profit community health plan, Fallon Health has worked to limit premium increases, filing the lowest average premium increases for the Health Connector product in the market from 2024 through 2026, Randall said. Consistent with our mission, we remain focused on balancing affordability and long-term sustainability so we can continue serving our members and supporting the communities that depend on us. Healey said the division's negotiation offers will save residents and businesses roughly $72 million in planned premium increases in 2027. Massachusetts residents and businesses are already struggling with the high cost of health care, the governor said. Nobody can afford massive increases in their health insurance premiums on top of that. But the double-digit premium increases underscore the ongoing health care affordability crisis, with residents increasingly unable to afford care that's exacerbated by high-deductible health plans. Healey's prized health care affordability work group has yet to publish recommendations that were expected last month. John Hurst, president of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts, said the approved rates are very disappointing. The average family plan will now have total premiums that top $50,000, he said. It's unaffordable, Hurst said. I mean, we continue to have looked at other ways on what's happening to real premium payers in Massachusetts. Blue Cross Blue Shield, which has the biggest enrollment at 166,384 members, was approved at a 13.2% rate increase. The insurer had proposed a 15.3. The state approved a 7.5 rate increase for Tufts Health, which has the second largest enrollment at 160,566 members. Tufts saw an 11.8 increase. Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare members will see the smallest premium increase of 6.7, which the insurer proposed proposed and the state didn't negotiate down. The approved rates exceed the cost growth benchmark of 3.6%, and a mechanism that has failed to meaningfully rein in spending. At a hearing last month, insurers attributed escalating cost pressures to skyrocketing pharmaceutical costs driven by the specialty drugs, plus steep provider reimbursement rates. Mass General Brigham Health Plan said it logged 17 claims last year that topped $1 million. Improving health care affordability for Massachusetts families and employers will ultimately require addressing the underlying drivers of health care costs across the entire health care system. Laura Pellegrini, CEO of the Massachusetts Association of Health Plans, said Wednesday. Pellegrini, a member of the Governor's Health Care Affordability Group, said she looks forward to the recommendations and meaningful action to address cost drivers in our marketplace and to provide health plans with needed tools to bend the healthcare cost trend for the customers we serve. Hurst said double-digit premium increases will force more small businesses to shut down. Whether the employee is paying $50,000 a year or the employer or they're sharing it, that is unaffordable. It's anti-competitive and it's shocking. The Beacon Hill just doesn't seem to get it, Hurst said. He added a lot of real premium payers, a lot of taxpayers, a lot of small businesses are really at the end of their rope. Okay, trade. Trump imposes double-digit tariffs on dozens of countries. out of Washington. President Donald Trump is going ahead with new double-digit tariffs on dozens of U.S. trading partners, just as the clock runs out Friday on stopgage levies he imposed after a stinging defeat at the Supreme Court. The United States will slap taxes of 10% to 12.5% on imports from 60 trading partners, accounting for 99% of U.S. imports, charging that they have inadequately enforced bans on goods produced by forced labor. The United States has had a forced labor import ban for nearly a century and rigorously enforces it. It's well past time for our trading partners to do the same, said U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer. The new tariffs will take effect just as temporary 10% worldwide tariffs expire at 12:01 a.m. Friday. Trump has returned to those temporary levies after the Supreme Court struck down his biggest and boldest tariffs in February. Now he's tapping more durable tariffs under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, which permits the president to impose import taxes and other sanctions against countries found to engage in unjustifiable, unreasonable, or discriminatory trade practices. Trump used Section 301 to impose big tariffs on China in his first term, and they survived court challenges. More Section 301 tariffs are likely coming. The U.S. Trade Representative's office has launched a probe into whether 16 countries, accounting for 70% of U.S. imports, have overproduced goods, pushing down prices and putting U.S. companies at a disadvantage in global markets. The administration has yet to complete that investigation. Trump, who argues that high tariffs will revive American manufacturing, last year overturned decades of U.S. policy that favored lower tariffs and even freer trade. Invoking the 1977 International Emergency Economic Power Act, IEEPA, he imposed double-digit tariffs on imports from almost every country on Earth, saying Americans' long-standing trade deficit amounted to a national emergency. But the Supreme Court ruled that the IEEPA did not authorize tariffs. The decision forced the administration to pay refunds to importers that had paid the tariffs. In response, Trump announced 10% worldwide tariffs under Section 122 of the Trade Act of 1974. But he can only use Section 122 levies for 150 days. That time runs out on Friday. The administration initially proposed the forced labor tariffs last month. Since then, some countries have tightened forced labor enforcement, qualified for lower tariffs, said a senior administration official who spoke under condition of anonymity. For example, the official said the tariff on imports from India initially was set at 12.5%, but now will be 10%. Some products, including oil and gas and fertilizer, are exempt from the new tariffs announced Thursday. Also being spared are products that qualify for duty-free status under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the North American trade pact Trump negotiated in his first term. The tariffs drew immediate fire from critics. Today's forced labor justification is too convenient to be taken seriously, said U.S. Representative Richard Neal of Massachusetts, the top Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee. Forced labor is a real and pervasive problem in our supply chains and demands serious enforcement. It should never be cheapened in a pretext for a tariff policy built on dubious legal theories and personal grievances. Brazil, which faces a 12.5% forced labor tariff, called the U.S. move arbitrary and unjustified in a statement. It plans to trigger its reciprocity law, which could call for retaliatory tariffs on the United States and take a complaint to the World Trade Organization. The United States, the Brazilian government said, chose to manipulate an issue of great importance to human rights and the struggle of workers worldwide in order to accuse 59 countries and the European Union of unfair practices. Tariffs paid by companies in the United States that import foreign products, The importers usually try to pass along the costs by charging consumer higher prices. Americans are already frustrated by the high cost of living, so the administration is taking a risk in rolling out new tariffs ahead of the November 3rd midterm elections. Human rights watchers say that it's reasonable to be skeptical of the motivation behind the tariffs, but they say the levies could make an impact on the problem of forced labor. The tariffs are being imposed on countries that the U.S. found either failed to impose or failed to effectively enforce a ban on importing goods made with forced labor. Forced labor is defined by the International Labor Organization Forced Labor Convention of 1930 as all work or services which is exacted from any person under the menace of any penalty for which the said person has not offered himself or herself voluntarily. According to the latest statistics from ILO, which is a UN agency focused on human labor rights, about 27.6 million people were in forced labor worldwide on any given day in 2021. We've gone on record for years now advocating for import bans, not as a magic bullet. It's not a silver bullet, but a potentially effective tool in combating forced labor across the globe, said Martina Vandenberg, founder and president of the Human Trafficking Legal Center. Hold on one second. Okay. It's possible to be extremely critical of tariffs, as we are, and to be very concerned about blanket tariffs used as a bludgeonings against countries, she said. And yet I think it's undeniable that there is a significant response in terms of the adoption of import bans. However, Vandenberg and her organization urged in testimony that the tariffs be implemented in a phased approach to give countries time to implement a ban or a plan for enforcement. Our concerns is that the import bans will be thin slips of paper with no enforcement, she said. Countries need time to build import ban mechanisms that are meaningful and enforceable. Kenya Davis, partner at Boies Schiller Flexner, said the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, a U.S. federal law passed in 2021 that prohibits the import of goods made wholly or in part in China's Yangjiang region or designated entities, is the most significant legislation related to forced labor that the U.S. has passed before the tariffs. The level of effectiveness is certainly up for debate, but it certainly has drawn attention to the issues of labor trafficking and forced labor, she said. And so, if nothing else, these import bans will serve that function of bringing greater awareness to forced labor. But without a comprehensive approach that provides transparency about the investigations consisted of and programs that provide countries aided in forced bans, I'm very cautious in my enthusiasm about the tariffs, she said. Isabel Glimcher, senior research scientist for global labor at the NYU Stern Center for Human Rights, said one law in the tariffs is that they focus on levying the tax on countries based on goods they import, not goods they make domestically. But, she said, the impending tariffs threat has spurred several countries, such as India, to amend their foreign trade policies to include a forced labor import ban. European Union forced labor regulations due to go into effect late next year are also contributing, she said. Not all of the things are necessarily or wholly attributable to the Section 301 investigations, but does seem like countries are responding and starting to take all of this seriously, she said. Next article, and I'm going to take a sip of water. Hold on. Okay, out of Minnesota, a man who killed lawmaker sentenced to life as family describes trauma and loss. Friends and family of Minnesota Democratic lawmaker Melissa Hortman said the man sentenced Thursday to two life terms plus 40 years after pleading guilty to her murder, failed to eliminate her legacy, but caused enduring fear and fury as he changed their lives forever. Excuse me. Fellow lawmakers and survivors of the shooting spoke Thursday at the sentencing hearing for Vance Bolliter, the man who pleaded guilty last month to federal charges related to killing the former House Speaker Hortman and her husband, Mark, as well as critically wounded State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, Yeti. Bolter, 59, agreed to plead guilty in June, almost a year after the Minneapolis area attacks, so federal prosecutors would not seek the death penalty. Mark Hortman's father and siblings voiced anger that he could not be sentenced to death. U.S. District Judge John Tunheim said it was the longest sentence I've imposed after hearing thousands of cases over the years, but I do believe it's deserved. In court Thursday, Senator Hoffman said he and his family are constantly reminded of the extraordinary violence of that night, even in the mundane details of day-to-day life. He said they don't receive mail at home anymore, that they've installed solid steel doors for protection, and they have changed how they do everyday tasks because of their injuries. The defendant looked me in the eyes and pulled the trigger. The defendant looked at my wife and chose to do the same, Hoffman said. My wife and I now live with injuries. We live with our bodies remembering the gunfire. Yvette Hoffman said she has been too traumatized to work since the attack in their home and that she sees a therapist weekly. I will never forget looking down and watching my blood slowly stream down that white washing machine as I felt myself sinking to the floor, she said, barely holding back tears. We always have an escape plan now. This isn't how people should live. Bolter admitted in court last month that he spent months identifying and stalking his targets before driving to their homes disguised as a police officer with the intention of killing them. The killing sparked the largest police search in state history. Democratic State Representative Kristen Bonner was one of the two other legislators whose homes Bolliter visited that night, but she and her family were on vacation. Bonner said the shootings had left her shaken. I could not fathom why I was spared, and Hortman was not, she said. You failed because I carry with me, in my mind and in my heart, she guides me. Mark Hortman's parents and siblings spoke of their anger Thursday, both of the man who killed him and the justice system. It will not offer me peace of mind that he will have room and board provided for the rest of his life, paid for by my tax dollars, said Lisa Hortman Bean, Mark's sister. Melissa Hortman's mother and father and the Hortman's children changed the tone of the statements when they spoke, remembering them as attentive, loving parents and grandparents and people who had a positive impact on the thousands of lives. Sophie Hortman, their daughter, described in vivid detail having to say goodbye to Gilbert, the golden retriever, also shot by Bolter, but who was still alive when they arrived at the veterinarian hospital. She talked about the bedtime routine her mother had with Gilbert, who failed his service dog test because he was too friendly, and the care and love she gave him. I miss my mom. I miss my dad. I miss my best friends. And I miss believing in the goodness of humanity. I hope that one day these aches feel less sharp. And I know just the love I feel for my parents, the pain will never go away, she said through tears. Colin Hortman talked about his parents not being at his recent wedding, about not dancing with his mother, who had hoped and would make his wedding cake. He described the horror of the house and the panic attacks and crying that have persisted in the year since they were killed. My days are filled with gray and the blood that was spilled in the last thing I see before I go to sleep and the first thing I see when I wake, he said. There is no sentence that weighs 15 gunshots, a murdered dog, and the rest of my life. It is impossible to realize the damage that has been done not only to our family but to our society, said Melissa's father, Harold Halitozik, who repeatedly referred to her as his little girl. I wish the perpetrator would have sat down and talked to Melissa about his political positions. If only he did that before he decided to kill them. Federal defender Manny Otwell spoke only briefly after the victim impact statements Thursday, saying Bolliter showed remorse for his actions by pleading guilty and accepting the life sentences. Bullitt remained silent and sat extremely still for most of the hearing, showing little emotion or reaction to the anguish expressed by the survivors and family members. To every person I have caused loss, pain, heartache, confusion, sadness, shame, or loneliness, I am truly sorry, he said. Bullitt pretended to be a police officer to gain access. Bullitt went to Hortman's home wearing a tactical uniform and mask about 3:30 a.m. on June 14, 2025. He rang the doorbell while shouting he was a police officer doing a welfare check, according to court documents. Mark Hortman answered the door. Bullitt gave him a fake name and badge number before requesting he summon Melissa Hortman to the door as well. He shot Mark Hortman multiple times before pushing into the house and shooting the lawmaker as she fled upstairs. Melissa and Mark Hortman were killed. Bullitt had already visited the Hoffman's home that night, shooting and critically injuring the senator and his wife, according to police and court documents. Court documents said Bullitt also went to Bonner's home that night as well as the home of another lawmaker. Bullitt also faces state charges, including 2 counts of murder, 4 counts of attempted murder, impersonating a police officer, and animal cruelty. Hoffman and his family filed personal injury lawsuits against Bullitt in April. Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty said in a statement Thursday that Bullitt's state prosecution would move forward immediately, noting a first appearance is scheduled for August 3rd. The targeted political violence he committed was horrific, Moriarty wrote. My thoughts are with Melissa and Mark's family, as well as John, Yvette, and Hope, as the state prosecution moves forward. This story has been corrected to show Bullitt apologized for causing loss, pain, heartache, confusion, sadness, shame, or loneliness, not for causing emotions. Next, student support services for homeless people out of Westford, Massachusetts. Advocacy for the Unhoused is a student-led nonprofit with chapters in Hopkinton, Westford, Holliston, and Medway. Students from the Westford group delivered supplies to homeless organizations and individuals in Boston on June 30th. The students spent the day supporting people experiencing homelessness with more than $3,000 in supplies raised through community fundraising. We split it into 3 teams, founder and president Mahav Saxena said. One handed out care packages directly to the unhoused individuals, one worked a meal shift in the kitchen at Rosie's Place, and one delivered supplies to Rosie's Place in Pine Street Inn. For more information, visit hauhelps.org. Out of Chelmsford, the Chelmsford Community Concert Band, directed by Eric Linsner, performs free Tuesday concerts on the Chelmsford Town Green at 7 p.m. between Westford Street and North Road. Bring a blanket or chair and bug spray. July 28th, Jazz Ensemble, directed by Art Bakopoulos. August 4th, Concert Band. August 11th, Jazz Ensemble, directed by Art Bakopoulos. August 18th, Concert Band. The band features a 75-piece concert band and 20-piece jazz ensemble of local volunteer musicians who have been bringing live music performances to this community since 1972. They depend on grants from local businesses, art organizations such as the Chelmsford Cultural Council, and individual donations. For more information, visit chelmsfordscommunityband.com. Out of Lowell, the 2026 Lowell Music Music Series continues this Thursday, scheduled the weekend following the Lowell Folk Festival, with a performance by J.J. Gray and Mofro on Sunday, August 2nd at 6:30 p.m. The series brings live music to Boarding House Park at Lowell National Historical Park near the historic Boot Mills at 40 French Street. Bring lawn chairs or blankets to enjoy the show, or opt for premium seating in the first 2 rows by the stage. The series is presented by the nonprofit Lowell Festival Foundation, which also offers Free Fun for Kids, a program of music and shows on Wednesday and Thursday mornings. Tickets are on sale for the following music shows: Iron and Wine, Friday, August 7th, Christone Kingfish Ingram, The Hard Road Tour, Saturday, August 8th, Ripe, Sunday, August 9th, Watch House, Friday, August 14th, Pink Talking Fish, Saturday, August 15th. The record company gives it back to you, 10th anniversary tour featuring special guest Charlie Musselwhite Duo, Thursday, August 20th, Lotus Land American Rush Tribute Band, Friday, August 21st, Margot Price, Friday, September 4th, and Graham Nash, as in Crosby, Stills, and Nash, live on tour 2026, Sunday, September 13th. Most shows start at 6:30 or 7:30 for a full schedule of events. And to purchase tickets, visit lowellsummermusic.org. Out of Wilmington, children book author Josh Funk visits Wilmington Town Hall Wednesday, August 5th from 6:30 p.m. 146 Middlesex Avenue. The event is free, but registration is required due to limited seating. Funk will discuss what it's like to write and publish picture books, answer audience questions, and wrap up the evening with a book signing and meet and greet. The event is hosted by the Wilmington Memorial Library and made possible through the Friends of the Wilmington Memorial Library. For more information, call 978-658-2967. All right, need to take a drink of water. Hold on. Jury seated in horrific Clancy case. Jury was seated yesterday, and opening statements are expected Monday in the case of Lindsay Clancy, the Duxbury mother on trial for the strangling murders of her three young children in 2023. But a motions hearing following the seating of the jury provided a preview of the intensity of the evidence six men and 12 women will have to sit through at trial. Lindsay Clancy, 36, a labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital at the time, is charged with the murder of her three children, Cora, 5, Dawson, 3, and Callan, 8 months, in the basement of the family home in Duxbury on January 24th, 2023. She also allegedly tried to kill herself afterwards, leaping from the master bed window on the upper floor to the ground below. She is now a paraplegic, and is stationed under psychiatric care at the Bridgewater State Hospital as she awaits trial. Her attorney, Kevin Reddington, has said she was under a medley of medications for severe postpartum depression and is mounting a psychiatric defense. Plymouth Superior Court Judge William Sullivan repeatedly had to stop both the prosecutor and defense attorney during heated motions arguments. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to end that now, Sullivan told prosecutor Jennifer Sprague at one point. Shortly after he had ended a Reddington argument, he also deemed as irrelevant to the motions argument. Reddington and Sprague had some strong feelings about what evidence should be relevant in a trial where Reddington is not contesting that the deaths of her children were at the hands of his client on January 24th, 2023. The circumstances of this horrific act are not in dispute, Reddington said. Patrick Clancy, the children's father, also has an attorney there, David Muir, pleading for certain evidence, like his own 911 call that night, pictures of the children and the children's clothing, to be restricted to the courtroom and not published by the media. What I can't fathom is the district attorney's intent to put a circus in front of this jury that calculated to just inflame the passions of the jury, Reddington said, adding that Patrick Clancy is trying to move on with his life and that his extended family is getting hounded and harassed by the public due to salacious media coverage. I still think it's reprehensible the way the government is trying this case, he said, of his own motion to limit the number of first responders to testify during the trial, saying that the testimony would be repetitive and serve no purpose other than to emotionally manipulate the jury. Sprague described Reddington's arguments as an attempt to brush past what happened to these children. She described the need for so many first responders on the stand because that is not a trial for a single mother, but a murderer of three children, each of whom were seen and tended to by first responders at the scene and then evaluated by medical staff and declared dead. That, she said, multiplies the number of testimonies needed to prove the case by three, and then one adds that Lindsay Clancy herself was treated, and so was Patrick Clancy. That makes for even more needed testimony. The Commonwealth did not choose the number of victims. The defendant did, Sprague said. The Commonwealth did not choose the ages of the victims. The defendant did. The Commonwealth did not choose the horrific nature in which they died. The defendant did. It's not the Commonwealth putting on a circus or a parade. It's the Commonwealth presenting the evidence in this case to prove the defendant killed those children and the manner in which they were killed, she said. Sullivan took Patrick Clancy's request under advisement and said he planned to rule on it Friday morning. He took no action on the defense motion to limit the number of first responders to testify. Okay. We're going to skip the arrest log. Okay. Kerrigan admits he blew .089. Mass Dems chair busted is the title of this article. The chair of the Massachusetts Democratic Party was arrested earlier this summer for alleged drunk driving, according to police records out of Southborough. According to Southborough police log dated June 13th, Mass Dems chair Steve Kerrigan, 54, was arrested for OUI liquor, negligent operation of a motor vehicle, and a marked lanes violation. According to the report, Kerrigan was arrested around midnight on Turnpike Road in Southborough. In June, I was pulled over for a marked lane violation and blew a .089 on the breathalyzer. I regret and take full responsibility for my actions and their consequences and appreciate the Southborough PD and Westborough Court for their professionalism and service, Kerrigan told the Herald in a written statement. According to court documents obtained by the Herald, Kerrigan had pleaded guilty to the charges in Westborough District Court, where Judge Michael Welsh sentenced him to a year of probation that ends June 15, 2027. The judge also ordered his license suspended for 45 days, a period that ends August 14th. Kerrigan also paid a total of $650 in fines and fees. As a result of this plea deal, Kerrigan's OUI charge was continued without a finding, with the negligent operation of a motor vehicle charge dismissed. He was found not responsible for the marked lanes violation. While Kerrigan's exact location the night leading up to his arrest were unclear, OCPF records show several political events Kerrigan would have reasonably been expected to have attended were held the night of June 12th, including a fundraiser for the Democratic State Representative Carol Fiola at Carrie Nation, a restaurant and cocktail bar on Beacon Street in Boston. The same day, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu also hosted an event at the UMass Club earlier that day, another venue where drinks were served. The drunk driving arrest came as Kerrigan and elected officials and other members of the Massachusetts Democratic Party have supported the push for a happy hour and extended last call at Bay State bars until 3 a.m. Kerrigan was elected chair of the state Democratic Party in April of 2023. Kerrigan also serves as a member of the Lancaster Select Board and as the president and CEO of the Edward M. Kennedy Community Health Center. He previously has worked as the principal of public affairs firm Kilgeaver Consulting Group. Kerrigan was also the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor in 2014, earning more than 220,000 votes and a loss. The Herald also requested comment from Mass DEMs as well as the Massachusetts Republican Party. Okay. Let's see. Weather. Tropical storm Bertha strikes near Texas-LA border in second landfall. Tropical storm Bertha made a second landfall Thursday near the Texas-Louisiana line after grazing southern Louisiana in a slow crawl that triggered heavy surf and some flooding along the Gulf Coast. Forecasters said more flooding was possible as heavy rains moved onshore into southeast Texas. Bertha moved inland about 75 miles northwest of Galveston, Texas on Thursday afternoon, the National Hurricane Center said. 3 hours later, it remained a tropical storm, though its maximum sustained winds had dropped to 40 miles per hour. More weakening was expected overnight. Thick clouds associated with Bertha prompted SpaceX to call the Thursday evening's planned Starship launch from the southern tip of Texas. The space skimming test flight was rescheduled for Friday when the forecast called for clear skies. No deaths or significant damage have been reported since Bertha formed Monday in the Gulf of Mexico south of the Florida Panhandle. The storm caused some coastal flooding as it centered first struck land Wednesday in Louisiana, southwest of New Orleans, but its heaviest rain stayed over the Gulf waters. So that's all good news. There's an awful lot of information on this hurricane, which I'm not going to read because I didn't realize that was that lengthy. Okay, let's move on to... I don't want to talk about that. Okay. Sorry, I'm trying to find something more positive that I could actually read. Okay, it's not overly positive, but... U.S. is ready to help end the senseless war in Ukraine, but no quick deal ahead. Out of Manila, Philippines, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Thursday that the Trump administration is poised to help end the senseless war in the Ukraine, but acknowledged there is no quick path to a deal, saying diplomacy and requires sustained effort and new ideas. Rubio, who held talks with Russia counterpart Sergey Lavrov in the Philippine capital, alluded to how U.S. mediated talks have stalled. He called them unsuccessful or at least unfruitful in the past, but insisted that President Donald Trump was committed to the work, if conditions and factors have changed to make that possible. That's been the challenge, an end that both sides can accept, Rubio told reporters. We've tried and, well, continued to try to see if we can, you know, find a middle ground that brings this about, and we're prepared to play that role if the opportunity presents itself. Rubio said Lavrov and several other leaders, including China's foreign minister, on the sidelines of an annual gathering for foreign ministers of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Manila. America's top diplomat said the U.S. is focused on Asia even as it steps up fighting with Iran, seeks a pathway to end Russia's war with the Ukraine, and pressures the Cuban government to make changes. 3 days of closed-door talks that started Tuesday have centered on the escalating fighting in the Middle East and tensions in the South China Sea, where a new clash flared Thursday. There's always going to be a concern that America is so focused on one place that it can't focus on another, Rubio said. But he noted the U.S. remains engaged in Asia every single day, citing strong partnerships and economic ties across the region. After meeting with Rubio, Lavrov largely ignored questions from reporters. The Russian Foreign Ministry in Moscow said he emphasized to Rubio the unacceptability of further arming Ukraine and accused European countries of pursuing Russia's strategic defeat. Lavrov reiterated Russia's readiness for a political and diplomatic resolution of the conflict and committed to agreements reached at a summit between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Trump in Alaska last year, the Russian ministry said. But, Rubio said, we'll have to find new suggestions and new ideas that are accepted to both sides. There has been no change to Washington's military support for Ukraine, with weapons being purchased by NATO allies and transferred to the war-ravaged country, he said. Separately, on Thursday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky reiterated that his priority is finding a way to get back to negotiations. U.S. efforts to broker an end to the Russian-Ukraine war has been overshadowed by the outbreak of the Iran war earlier this year. Renewed strikes by Washington and Tehran have been intensifying after an interim ceasefire deal collapsed. The price will continue to get higher every single night until they come to their senses, Rubio said. He insisted Tehran is begging for talks about Trump. But Trump does not see the use in responding because Iran is clearly not ready to make a deal, at least not one they're willing to live by. Trump has warned Iran the U.S. will destroy one Iranian bridge or power plant each time Iran shoots at a ship in the Strait of Hormuz. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Aragachi responded by saying the country's defense doctrine was an eye for an eye. The president's policy is a head for an eye, Rubio said. They will pay a heavy, very heavy price for the things they're doing. Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong renewed her country's alarm over the Chinese Navy recent test launch of a missile from a nuclear-powered submarine in the region, saying the lack of notification to the Philippines and Pacific nations where the missile flew over and landed was destabilizing. It comes in the context of a rapid military buildup of China's nuclear arsenal without the transparency or reassurance the region expects, Wong told the University Forum in Manila on Thursday. This is why Australia has described the test as provocative and destabilizing. China has defended its actions, saying the launch was part of an annual exercise that it gave countries in the area appropriate notice in advance. Rubio met Wednesday with Chinese Foreign Minister Yang Yi and said they discussed a new altercation this week between Chinese and Filipino forces in a dispute shoal in the Southern Chinese Sea, which Beijing claims virtually is its entity. Rubio called the incident escalatory. Those need to be managed very carefully because obviously a conflict, be it economic or otherwise, between the U.S. and China would have a dramatic global impact, Rubio said. He also said they talked a lot about Chinese leader Xi Jinping's plan trip in September, noting he believes Xi will have a very positive visit when he comes to Washington. In Beijing, the Chinese Coast Guard said it took necessary measures, including monitoring and blocking, to drive away two Philippine ships that disregarded repeat warnings from the Chinese side in a fresh confrontation Thursday. China said its operations were professional and lawful and urged the Philippines to stop its provocative actions infringing on Chinese territory. The Philippine Coast Guard, however, said the two fishing vessels were harassed while bringing fuel aid to Filipino fishermen in the Scarborough Shoal. It said a Chinese Coast Guard ship tried to spray one vessel with a powerful water cannon but missed, calling these illegal, coercive, and aggressive actions. The Trump administration has repeatedly criticized China's assertive actions in the South China Sea to the disadvantage of smaller claimant countries like Philippines, Washington's oldest treaty ally in Asia, Taiwan, and ASEAN members of Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei have also been involved in the often tense territorial standoff. ASEAN aims to conclude year-long negotiations with China on a proposed non-aggressive pact by this year, according to a draft of a joint committee seen by the Associated Press. The code of conduct aims to prevent a major conflict in the disputed waters, a key global trade route that could draw into the United States. Associated Press, oh, I don't need to tell you who wrote what. Okay. Today in history. Today's highlight, July 24th, 1969, the Apollo 11 astronauts, two of whom have been the first men to set foot on the moon, splashed down safely in the Pacific. Also on this date, in 1858, Republican senatorial candidate Abraham Lincoln formally challenged Democrat Stephen Douglas to a series of political debates. The result was seven face-to-face encounters. In 1862, Martin Van Buren, the eighth president of the United States and the first to have been born a U.S. citizen, died at age 79 in Kinkerhook, New York, the town where he was born in 1782. Wow, living to 79 back then was huge. In 1866, Tennessee became the first state to be remitted to the Union after the Civil War. In 1915, the SS Eastland, a passenger ship carrying more than 2,500 people, rolled onto its side while docked at the Clark Street Bridge on the Chicago River. An estimated 844 people died in the disaster. In 1937, the state of Alabama dropped charges against four of the nine young black men accused of raping two women in the Scottboro case. In 1959, during a visit to Moscow, President Richard Nixon engaged in his famous kitchen debate with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. In 1974, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that President Richard Nixon had to turn over subpoenaed White House tape recordings to the Watergate special prosecutor. In 1998, a gunman burst into the U.S. Capitol, killing two police officers before being shot and captured. In 2010, a stampede inside a tunnel crowded with techno music fans left 21 people dead and more than 500 injured at the famed Love Parade Festival in Duisburg, Germany. In 2013, a high-speed train crash outside Santiago de Compostela in northwest Spain killed 79 people. And lastly, in 2025, an Antonov AN-24 turboprop passenger plane operated by Angara Airlines crashed near Tynda in Russia's Far East, killing 48 passengers and crew. Okay. Toll from landslide in southwestern China rises to 11 dead out of Beijing. Teams searching the rubble of last week's landslide in the southwestern Chinese city of Chongqing found three additional bodies in recent days, bringing the death toll to 11, with 50 people still missing. The search continues, but there have been no recent signs of life after many efforts to detect additional survivors from Friday's collapse in Peishu County at the edge of the city, the country government said in a statement. Responders found eight bodies soon after the collapse, which buried more than 10 residential buildings and 10 people were injured. The rescue work has been exceptionally challenging due to the massive volume of collapsed materials that includes many large boulders. Searchers have used heavy machinery and drones, and teams have blasted some of the boulders into small pieces as part of the rescue work, according to the government. Okay, also out of Quetta, Pakistan, suspected militants killed judge, security guard, and Pakistan ambush. Suspected militants ambushed a vehicle carrying a district judge in restive southwestern Pakistan on Thursday, killing him and his security guard before fleeing the scene, police said, as Pakistan's powerful army chief vowed to dismantle terrorist infrastructures wherever it poses a threat to the country and its people. The attack occurred in Mostung, a district in Balochistan province, where separatist insurgents have stepped up attacks on security forces and civilians in recent months. Security forces responding to multiple recent attacks have killed over 100 alleged insurgents from Baloch groups in various areas in Balochistan in recent weeks. A local police chief in Mostung, Abdul Rauf, said Judge Abdul Hakim Kakar was traveling from Quetta, the provincial capital, to Mostung to hear cases when terrorists ambushed his vehicle and killed him and his guard. Sad. Okay, out of Havana, hundreds of boxes of humanitarian aid from the U.S. are being distributed in two towns near the Cuban capital. The Catholic Church organizations in charge of the distribution said Thursday. The aid arrived this week and its distribution began on Wednesday. It is shrouded in controversy due to the longstanding political distrust between Cuba and the U.S. and comes amid a crisis on the island exacerbated by an energy embargo imposed in January by U.S. President Donald Trump. Caritas began distributing the boxes to unspecified parishes and religious houses in the municipalities of Bejucal and Alquizar, which border Havana, according to a statement from the organization. The food and hygiene kits will be distributed to the most vulnerable Cuban families, the state said. Statement said. Images released by the organization showed people unloading brown cardboard boxes, donning the U.S. flag. Wildfire spread near Frenchtown as 20,000 people are evacuated. In Paris, about 20,000 people were evacuated from towns and vacation resorts along the French Atlantic coast Thursday. At the latest in a series of wildfires raged and hundreds of firefighters were dispatched to tackle it. Local authorities said the fire in a forest near the town of Legay-Cap-Ferret, southwest of Bordeaux, spread over more than 31 square kilometers, or 12 square miles, though no injuries have been reported. The prefect or head of the surrounding Gironde region, Sophie Brocas, said some 700 firefighters have been deployed, including forces sent from the Paris region. The fire came with 300 meters, or 980 feet, of the first home in Legay, and water bombers were being used. Later in the day, the prefect's office said the wildfire has not yet been brought under control but remained contained to the north of Legay. More than 10,000 people, including tourists staying at holiday camps and campgrounds, were moved to safety overnight. And where are we at? Okay, I am going to hold off on the opinion page. I think I'm going to take a break now because I'm losing my voice, and I shall return shortly. Thank you for listening thus far.
This is by Jamie Gans. The Today Show is implementing stricter security protocols in the days since a man was arrested for sneaking into the NBC studio where he swung at Craig Melvin and used racial slurs against the beloved co-anchor. Nearly a week after a security guard was fired for the breach, Variety reports that your team at Today sent an email Wednesday to PR firms detailing an important update regarding studio access for Today's interviews. In light of the recent events last week, we are implementing stricter security protocols effective immediately, continued the notice. From here on out, each guest is afforded a maximum amount of two people in the studio, including those that accompanying that individual, be it publicist, stylist, or any other support personnel, no exceptions. If guests must bring additional personnel, though, they're more than welcome to wait in the green room. And I see we're coming to the end of our time with you, so I'll read today's horoscope. July 24th. Where's the summer going? And here's your happy birthday if today's your birthday. And here's your horoscope. It's your year of the exceptional standard in which you're the one who gets to decide what quality looks like. As your expectations become your everyday reality, you'll find yourself eating, sleeping, working, loving, and living better. More highlights? You'll attract both admirers and eager students, new styles and environments. Your inner life gets stronger in the same way muscles do. Repetition. Libra and Capricorn adore you, and your lucky numbers are 1, 13, 11, 17, and 26. And this has been Bob
and Donnie
reading from the July 24th issue of the Boston Herald. We thank you so much for listening, and have a fantastic Friday.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, sunny, temperatures in the mid-80s. Clear overnight, temperatures in the lower 60s. Saturday, sunny, temperatures in the lower 80s. The sun rose this morning at 5:30, setting at 8:12 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
Hey, wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind. Like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Or that time you forgot to roll up your windows in the car wash.
Fantastic.
Yeah, a remote control would have come in handy then. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome. But prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Life doesn't come with a remote control. So you're on your own with the wasps. You have the power to take control of prediabetes. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRS LP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVAO LP Athol, WDJ. I'm Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center. Today is Friday, July 24, 2026, and here are the top stories from the Washington Post. Saudi nuclear deal in doubt as Trump adds new condition regarding Israel. By Michael Birnbaum and Evan Halper. Saudi Arabia would need to normalize relations with Israel to receive the U.S. nuclear technology it has long sought, President Donald Trump said Thursday, adding a new and potentially deal-ending stipulation to an agreement signed just a day earlier. The nuclear deal, which was fiercely opposed by Israel and others concerned about nuclear proliferation, is totally subject to Saudi Arabia joining the Abraham Accords, Trump said in a social media post, referring to the effort from his first term to normalize relations between Israel and Muslim-majority countries from which it had long been estranged. The Saudis have thus far refused to join the accord. It was the latest whiplash-inducing policy shift from the White House, which had faced down considerable political opposition to push forward with the Saudi deal. The Biden administration also discussed a nuclear deal with Saudi Arabia, but tied any agreement to opening diplomatic relations with Israel, a move that has the potential to reshape dynamics in the Middle East, but which remains distant. If the Saudis don't join the Abraham Accords, the deal is off, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said a few hours after Trump's post, responding to questions from reporters. Asked why that condition had not been included in the deal when it was announced Wednesday, Leavitt said that Trump is always the final dealmaker. It wasn't immediately clear how the Trump administration would modify a legal agreement that it has already signed with the Saudi government. Asked for details, the White House pointed to Leavitt's comments. The deal to allow the Saudis to build nuclear power plants using U.S. technology, creating a pathway to a Saudi nuclear enrichment program, has set off debate in Congress. Many lawmakers fear that allowing more countries to develop enrichment programs could eventually lead to more possessing nuclear weapons. Israel hotly opposes Saudi Arabia's developing a nuclear enrichment program, fearful it could lead to a regional arms race. Israeli leaders welcomed Trump's new conditions. The Saudis have long sought to build nuclear power plants on their territory, and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the country, has declared that they would work to develop nuclear weapons if Iran develops its own. The Biden administration also explored a nuclear deal with Saudi Arabia, but it ultimately floundered because normalizing relations with Israel was the main condition the U.S. placed on the agreement. The deal the Trump administration signed Wednesday would have imposed no such requirement. Trump's new condition on Thursday would attach a major string to the deal. Saudi leaders were nearing a normalization agreement with Israel in 2023, just before the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7 of that year. Since then, however, talks have been paused. Saudi leaders now say they would want guarantees of an eventual Palestinian state, and Saudi public opinion has soured toward Israel because of its handling of the war in Gaza. Any nuclear deal tied to Saudi-Israel diplomatic breakthroughs has seemed remote. The civil nuclear deal, there will be no enrichment of material, being made between the United States Department of Energy and Saudi Arabia, which pertains only to non-military use such as the ones that Iran and UAE and others already have, will be approved, Trump wrote on Truth Social on Thursday, but it is totally subject to Saudi Arabia joining the very respected and successful Abraham Accords. The Abraham Accords, signed in 2020, normalized diplomatic and economic ties between Israel and Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates. Morocco later joined. Saudi Arabia is a heavyweight of the Middle East. Boosting ties to Israel would be a major shift in a region long beset by religious tensions. The president's assertion that there would be no nuclear enrichment as part of the deal appears to contradict how people familiar with the deal have described it. Most of the deal's details remain private. The president will need to submit the agreement to Congress, starting a 90-day clock for approval. That move could take place as early as today. It is unlikely Congress will be able to stop the deal, even if there is substantial opposition. The president could veto their disapproval, and opponents are unlikely to have the votes to override him. But Trump's new condition could stymie the deal even before it gets off the ground. Trump had not spoken to Mohammed in the hours since the social media announcement, Levitt said, nor did he speak to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, she said. It was just the latest example of the president's on-again, off-again approach to policymaking. Last week, Trump said that the United States would impose a 20% toll on shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, despite months in which his own administration said that doing so would be a violation of international law. A day later, and following widespread condemnation, he abandoned the idea, saying he would make investment deals with Persian Gulf countries instead. The agreement that Energy Secretary Chris Wright and his Saudi counterpart signed Wednesday lays out conditions for nuclear energy cooperation and includes stipulations aimed at preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. But unlike other recent deals with countries that do not already have a domestic enrichment program, this one would not impose the same strict conditions aimed at preventing them from moving in that direction. The initial announcement of the deal on Wednesday drew condemnation in Israel, where leaders fear a Saudi nuclear program could spur a regional arms race. Israelis worry that Turkey and others could also seek nuclear enrichment programs.
I am back, and you are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank you, Mass Lowell's WUML-FM, for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Okay, on to the editorial page. Poll elicits genuine unease with lack of AI safeguards. A recent taking of voter sentiment concerning the increasingly unfettered influence of artificial intelligence exposed a growing love-hate relationship and the need for government oversight before this genie permanently bolts the regulatory bottle. 3/4 of Massachusetts voters support proposed regulations that would establish a commission to oversee AI companies, according to a survey released by the Mass Inc. polling group on Monday. The poll's release coincides with Senate deliberations on an economic development bill that calls for such a panel to consider AI regulatory and safety issues, like the hiring of third-party auditors to verify that developers adhere to safety protocols. The bill features other AI safeguards, including requiring major developers to create safety frameworks. The survey found that 75% of state voters said they would either strongly support or somewhat support the proposed AI regulation bill. The poll also found that at least 65% of those surveyed across Massachusetts have concerns about the potential dangers of artificial intelligence. The poll's sponsor, Anthropic, the San Francisco-based company that created the AI platform Claude, has consistently supported stronger government oversight of the industry, more so than many of its competitors. Ironically, Anthropic currently finds itself locked in a high-stakes legal battle with the U.S. Department of Defense over the military's use of its artificial intelligence models, such as Claude. The Pentagon demanded that Anthropic allow its AI to be used for all lawful purposes, which Anthropic interpreted as an attempt to bypass its safety policies and deploy Claude for lethal autonomous weapons and domestic massive surveillance. The poll also found that the higher income voters are more likely to be excited about how AI can help humanity. But even within this group, at least half said they were not concerned. They were more concerned than excited. Absent regulations, at least 82% of respondents said they feel that AI systems could create serious risks, like enabling chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear harms, or large-scale cyber attacks. Though not included in the survey part of the poll, respondents' AI anxiety could be attributing to the mounting opposition to the construction of related massive data centers, which puts severe strains on municipal resources. Experts have noted that AI exponentially drives the explosive growth of data centers, which is in turn creates severe resources, land, and water strains. These municipal equivalent electricity usage facilities also consume billions of gallons of water, often burdening local communities. But despite concerns about AI among poll respondents, most people still use it. According to the poll, 61% of respondents reported using AI tools like ChatGPT, Claude, Google Gemini, or Copilot, while nearly 40% reported using AI tools weekly. I think they, people, feel a little disoriented, they feel a little powerless, and they want to exert what power they have through their elected representatives to do something about it, said Andrew Doris, policy director at Secure AI Project. I think right now the government's kind of caught flat-footed by some of this and reaching for tools that are not fit for purpose, and they lack that actual system in place to know how to handle this, he said. Doris added that the process also needs to be informed by technical experts who are both independent from AI companies and political pressures. The poll found that respondents generally support a list of 9 regulatory steps, including reporting urgent safety problems within 24 hours, protecting AI company employees who report safety problems, updating their safety plan at least once a year, and paying up to $1 million for each violation. While Republican voters are less supportive, the 9 proposed regulations across all poll respondents received an average of 56% favorability rating. Most voters said they would prefer to see Massachusetts lead the way on the setting AI safety standards instead of waiting for other states or the federal government to act. But our state already finds itself behind the curve when it comes to regulating AI. Bola Clarn Thomas, state and local government relations lead at Anthropic confirmed the California and New York advanced robust AI safety laws last year. And just last week, Illinois signed the strongest AI safety bill into law. The Illinois legislation establishes some of the most rigorous AI safety and accountability requirements in the country. It targets major developers earning over $500 million annually, requiring them to publish the detailed safety frameworks. It also mandates independent evaluations of safety practices by auditors without financial conflict of interest, an industry first. States are absolutely in the driver's seat, and the question isn't between state action versus federal action. It's a question of state action versus no action, and letting the technology evolve without safeguards set in place, Thomas said. With states, they're tasked with protecting roads, protecting infrastructure, and that's some of the things that the bill would protect. While this state has already demanded more transparency from data centers, it's yet to put an AI protocol into place. If a major AI creator like Anthropic sees the need for industry oversight, it behooves Massachusetts to at least enact its own safeguards. Okay, next, local folk festival. Local businesses add street-level vibe. Freshly spun cotton candy, books, local goods, beer-boiled hot dogs, among many offerings out of Lowell. Long before the performers take one of the five stages during the 39th Lowell Folk Festival, local businesses in town in the downtown area are setting up sidewalk stages outside their front doors. The festival opens with traditional parade of flags at 6:15 p.m. Friday and runs through Sunday. Nearly all of downtown will be closed to vehicle traffic to create a walkable festival universe, which will feature more than 60 musical and dance performances on five different stages, food vendors serving a variety of distinctive culinary experiences, numerous art and family exhibits, and dance tents. Concurrent to the annual effort, a record number of downtown businesses, from bakeries to bookstores, cafes to coffee shops and restaurants to running gear, are participating in Lowell's storied tradition, adding to the festival vibe and foot traffic. The Lowell General Store at 53 Market Street received its sidewalk permit from the License Commission earlier this month for expanded sidewalk display featuring gifts, apparel, home goods, pet products, and other items from the more than 60 local makers and small businesses the storefront carries. The goal is to showcase what makes Lowell community so special, owner Ken Machizi said, for it's an opportunity to introduce thousands of visitors to the local businesses, artists, makers, and entrepreneurs who call Lowell home. Restaurants and bakeries add to the festival flavor. Restaurants increase the festival vibe by hosting their own mini music and food festivals. The Worthen House at 141 Worthen Street celebrates 20 years with its annual Worthen Fest, featuring bands and other musical acts Friday through Sunday. The oldest tavern in Lowell is a block away from the festival's Rockland Trust Bank Dance Pavilion at Arcade Drive behind City Hall. Owner Penny Hamragos says hosting a free festival alongside the Free Folk Festival is sharing into a piece of Lowell's history. 20 years of Worthen Fest means 20 years of this city showing up for us and for each other, she said by email Wednesday. The Worthen has been part of Lowell's story since 1898, and this festival is our way of saying thank you to everyone who travels in from across the country to be part of it, and to the neighborhood right here that makes it so special. In addition to music, the Worthen's extensive menus offers hot dogs boiled in water or beer for hungry patrons. Chef Chris D'Amato is working the grill all weekend, with bartender April Underwood handling the drink menu. In the kitchen of Athenian Corner Restaurant at 207 Market Street, Raymond Torres is cutting up 40 to 50 pounds of chicken for this weekend's takeout tent and streetery space. Streeteries are private seating areas located in the public right-of-way that converts curbside parking spaces into an outdoor dining space for customers of the adjacent participating restaurants. The menu features spanakopita, stuffed grape leaves, baklava, and other items. It's a great place to enjoy the flavor of the festival and meet people, said Teddy Panos. The Acre native is part of the legendary Panagiotopoulos family, sorry if I mispronounced that, I know I did, that owns and operates the Greek restaurant. And it's a great place to enjoy a meal and a drink while listening to performers from the Folk Festival Market Street stage on Saturday and Sunday. The restaurant, the takeout tent, and the streetery will be open all 3 days of the festival. For lighter fare, Pizzelle Bakery at 201 Market Street will feature freshly spun cotton candy, snow cones, and their own syrups, homemade ice cream sandwiches and sorbets, as well as their regular menu of European-style breads and pastries with vegan and gluten-free options. We've been doing Lowell Folk Festival for 3 years, owner Sharon Ehrenberg said. For those needing a mid-morning or afternoon jolt, the Coffee Mill Emporium will be set up on Saturday only with their selection of specialty and regular hot and iced coffees and breakfast menu. This year we're adding in a Red Bull coffee infusion and fresh squeezed lemonade, said owner Pina Amato, who has been doing the Folk Festival for 4 years. Hive Public Market, Mark's Running and Fitness Center, the restaurant Fork, One Urban Tribe, Cafe Eclipse, the Coffee Mill Emporium, Lala Books, El Potro, Sutra Yoga Studio, Tremonti Pizzeria, Cobblestone, and others applied for sidewalk stand permits for the 2026 Folk Festival and seasonal through October, as well as for special event permits for amplified outdoor public entertainment, special one-day licenses to sell and dispense malt beverages and wines, and permits for expanded sidewalk and parking lot seating. Besides the food, spirits, music, and merchandise that celebrate this weekend's Folk Festival, other organizations are contributing to the festival vibe. The Lowell Waterways Vitality Initiative will light up the John Cox Memorial Bridge in rainbow colors each evening of the weekend festival starting Friday. The bridge spans for the Merrimack River and serves as a gateway to Lowell's Centerville neighborhood and the town of Draycott. It funnels visitors directly onto the aptly named Bridge Street to area garages and lots, including the Joseph Downs Garage on John Street and the Leo Roy Garage on Market Street, both of which will be accessible during the festival. Street closures have been reported to Waze navigation app. Mild weather is in the forecast, which should encourage visitors to attend the outdoor events, although even high temperatures and storms didn't keep away the crowds in previous years. The 39th Folk Festival coincides with Lowell's bicentennial. Those historic milestones represent the city's staying powered, said Hammer Gurris. This is not a party for us. Oh, wait a minute. Here at the Worthen, it's a piece of Lowell's history, still very much alive, and something we look forward to continuing into the future, she said. Okay, let's skip the sports, because if I don't have to read it, I won't. Though the Red Sox are doing amazing this year, we are still skipping over it. Okay, let's see what I have next to read. Summer Corn Soup. We're not going to do that. That's just a quick fix meal. That's looking at the stories behind the game, is behind the bylines is the name of this. I joined my family for World Cup final watch party this past Sunday. Like millions around the world, we were transfixed. Every pass elicited a reaction. Shots were followed by bated breath. Most of my family had followed the tournament with great interest and anticipation, and those few hours were the culmination of months of emotional investment, accumulated history, and hope. I, however, had not been following, in part because I don't have a great affinity for watching sports, despite having a deep appreciation for athleticism, but also because of my discomfort with FIFA, which has given viewers plenty of reasons to question the ethics behind the spectacle of the World Cup. During my usual perusal of the news the next morning, I encountered story after story documenting Argentina's tragedy and Spain's triumph. I found myself tumbling headfirst into a pile of analysis, profiles, and the stories that turned individual plays into a narrative woven through history, strategy, triumph, and tragedy. Sports journalism is sometimes treated as a lighter form of work, perhaps because its most visible subject is a game. The stakes are not life and death, though certain fandoms certainly seem to feel otherwise. Yet the best sports writing does what all strong journalists should do. It uses what happened to help us understand why it happened. In some cases, it helps us see who has been metaphorically sidelined. As I went further down the rabbit hole, reading everything from critiques to key players to histories of the game, I stumbled upon award-winning author Hannah Adurquibs, I don't know how to pronounce that, 2018 New York Times opinion piece, The Kind of Kid America Needs If We Want a World Cup. The piece describes Clint Dempsey, a player who overcame numerous challenges to reach the world stage. Dempsey grew up in a trailer behind his grandparents' house and drove a six-hour round trip 3 days a week to practice. But instead of just telling another story about an athlete who defied the odds, Abdurraqib, a cultural critic, used Dempsey's journey to examine the costly pay-to-play system that shapes American youth soccer. We are accustomed to turning an athlete's hardship into part of the hero's journey. Poverty, long drives, limited resources, a family sacrifice become evidence of exceptional perseverance. When an athlete overcomes these obstacles, we see their achievement as more impressive. This framing offers a tidy and motivating narrative, but it can also flatter an inequitable system. It rightfully directs our attention to the remarkable person who survived the barriers, but in the process lets fall by the wayside our consideration of the many people those barriers removed from contention. The inequity may appear less consequential because sports are, after all, games. No one is entitled to become a professional athlete, but systems of athletic development decide whose talent is identified and coached and how to access facilities, programs, scholarships, and professional opportunities are distributed. They also shape who eventually represents a city, a community, or a country. And of course, the stories of triumph are welcome, but many of the pieces demonstrated the power of sports journalism to move beyond the spectacle of achievement and expose the systems that shape who is given the chance to achieve in the first place, and ask why so much of it was required in the first place. I may not have been bitten by the World Cup bug this year, but I came away with a renewed appreciation for sports journalism and the revelatory power of stories that show us not only what happens in the game, but the system that shaped it. This was written by Wafa Unis, is an associated professor of journalism at Fitchburg State University. Okay, advice. This is a Dear Annie. Your first job doesn't have to be your last. Dear Annie, I am a recent college grad, and I've always wanted to be a writer like you. I've applied to more jobs than I can count at newspapers and magazines, but haven't landed a single offer. Everyone keeps saying the job market is tough right now, but knowing that doesn't pay rent. I still live with my parents, and I'm dying to get my own place. I don't want to give up on writing, but it's 6 months with no offer, and I need to start making some money. What do I do? Signed, Unpublished. Dear Unpublished, writing skills are limited to bylines, marketing, PR, and corporate communications. All need people who can put a sentence together well and on deadline. Expand your job search. Take one of those jobs and get your own apartment. Keep writing on the side. Post it online, pitch it around, and build a portfolio. You never know where that might take you. Dear Annie, my daughter is dating a man who is an alcoholic and drug addict. Over the past 3 years, the police have been called multiple times because he's abused her. She has 2 children, 8 and 15, who live with her. I've tried to talk some sense into her, but she always defends him and even even interferes with his arrests. Thankfully, the court stepped in and he was sentenced to 6 months in jail for the abuse. Now my daughter wants nothing to do with me and I won't and won't let me see my grandchildren. When I call, she says they don't want to talk to me and tells me to leave them alone. I feel like she's using the children as weapons against me. She lived with me for 40 years, and I've never seen her act this way. Her boyfriend was once married to a friend of mine. He tried to isolate my friend's daughter from her family and friends, too. I don't know how to get through to my daughter that she needs to stay away from him. She used to be such a good person. Now it's as though she's become someone I don't recognize. It's eating me alive that my grandchildren are no longer part of my life. I don't know what to do. Please help. Signed, Heartbroken Grandmother. Dear heartbroken grandmother, everything you've described is consistent with a toxic and abusive relationship. One of the first things abusers often do is isolate that partners from the people who might help them leave. Your daughter may not become this cold and unemotional person. She may simply be in survival mode. As heartbreaking as this is, you can't force your daughter to end this relationship, no matter how much you love her. What you can do is leave the door open. Keep your messages to her calm, loving, and free of criticism about her boyfriend. Just remind her you'll be there for her and the kids if and when she's ready. If you believe your grandchildren are in imminent danger, contact Child Protective Services or law enforcement. Sometimes the most loving thing you can do isn't to talk sense into someone, but to make sure they know they have a safe place to land if they decide to leave. Okay. Movies. Musk documentary, CIA comedy, led to Venice Film Festival lineup. Hold on for 1 second. Okay, sorry. A 4-hour documentary about Elon Musk, Martin McDonough, I guess, dark CIA comedy Wild Horse 9, and films featuring Robert Pattinson, Penelope Cruz, and Javier Bardem are among the movies premiering at the Venice Film Festival in September. Alberto Barbera, the festival's artistic director, unveiled the lineup Thursday at the 83rd edition of the festival, the first of many in a busy fall film season that culminates in Hollywood's awards showdown. Like the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year, the selection is lighter on Hollywood studio films than in years past. Wild Horse 9, starring John Malkovich and Sam Rockwell as CIA agents in Chile before the 1973 coup, is among the higher profile titles playing in competition. I will play alongside Primetime, in which Pattinson stars as To Catch a Predator host Chris Hansen. The broader slate has anticipated documentaries like Alex Gibney, Musk, a sweeping portrait of the billionaire, and Julia Loktava's The Undesirable Friends, Part 2 Exile, which follows Russian independent journalists after they leave the country. Similar to the first part, it runs 355 minutes. That's a lot. The festival's main competition includes a diverse array of international and American films like Werner Herzog's Bucking Festard, in which Sister Rooney and Kate Mara play identical twins. Also on the program are Florian Zeller's thriller Bunker, with Bardem and Cruz playing a married couple, Lee Chang-dong's Possible Love, Stephanie Briz's A Good Little Soldier, and Hirokazu Koreeda's Look Back, a coming-of-age story about two girls who dream of being manga artists. Excuse me. Casey Affleck will be the competition for the first time with Company, starring Nick Nolte and Ben Mendelsohn. Manny Moretti also returns for the first time since 1989. Notable documentary premieres of the competition include Oasis, Don't Look Back in Anger, Barbara Kopple's Uniontown, Elizabeth Chi Vassarelli's and Jimmy Chin's Everest, The Other Side, Luca Guadagnino's 7-hour Bernardo Bertolucci film, Joie de Vivre. Wim Wenders' look at architect Peter Zumthor. Russell Crowe's autobiographical music concert movie, What's Love Builds, and Laura Poitras' short about U.S. immigration and customs enforcement in Minneapolis, They're Here. Barbera said he expects Noel and Liam Gallagher to attend on behalf of the film, which was directed by Stephen Knight and will be in theaters soon after September 11th. The festival is set to open on September 2nd with Danny Boyle, Inc., an adaptation of James Graham's stage play, which dramatizes the rise of media tycoon Rupert Murdoch. Inc. is also playing in the main competition and in the running for awards such as the Golden Lion, a prize that is decided upon by a jury led this year by filmmaker and actor Maggie Gyllenhaal. Other jurors include filmmakers like Kauthar Ben-Haninia, Johnny Toe, and Shahrbanu Sadat, and composer Daniel Bloomberg. Gyllenhaal has a film playing as well, a Marilyn Monroe-inspired short, Flesh Impact, in which Dakota Johnson and Ellen Burstyn give body and voice to the myth of Marilyn. Barbera said the 93-year-old Burstyn will also get a Lifetime Achievement Award from the festival. Venice has the last 15 years proved a desirable launching pad for Oscar hopefuls, even if not everything breaks through. Last year's edition had plenty of star power in the lineup with Julia Roberts, George Clooney, and Dwayne Johnson movies among the splashy premieres. But the Globe Festival moment was short-lived. The films After the Hunt and Jay Kelly and The Smashing Machine were neither triumphant with audiences and theaters, Jay Kelly was a Netflix release, nor with award voters. Still, there's usually a big picture nominee, and the slate last year there were two in Frankenstein and Bugnoia. This year won't be bereft of a Clooney moment either. The Venice regular is getting a Lifetime Achievement Award. Okay, that was a very difficult article to read, and I apologize for all the mispronunciations. Horoscopes, Aries, March 21st through April 19th. This is a lovely romantic day. In particular, it's the perfect day to tell someone how much you care for them. This might be a family member or someone who lives with you. It might be a coworker, and of course, it could be a romantic interest. Tonight, study and learn. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th. All your conversations with others are charming today because you have the gift of gab. Your words are sweet and people want to hear what you have to say. You might choose today to tell siblings, relatives, and neighbors something positive, something they will want to hear. Tonight, check your finances. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. Financial discussions will go well today because you will be tactful, diplomatic, and also convincing in a subtle way. They won't even see you coming. Whatever transpires, you will be the one who's laughing all the way to the bank. You also might shop for beautiful things today. Tonight, be affectionate. Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. This is a great day to play hooky. Today you'll enjoy reading for pleasure, socializing, enjoying concerts, and doing anything where you can appreciate the beauty and talents of others. Visit art galleries, museums, architectural buildings, and parks. Tonight, get organized. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. Enjoy schmoozing today. Accept invitations to socialize. Sport events, the arts, museums, galleries, and fun activities with kids will appeal. This is a very romantic day. A new romance can begin and existing relationships can blossom because it's easy for people to express their affection for each other. Tonight, socialize and have fun. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. Romance is in the air today, making this a lovely sociable day. However, it's also an excellent day for you to buy wardrobe goodies. Enjoy the company of friends and groups. Someone's feedback or advice might be helpful. Bonus, tonight, relax. Libra, September 23rd through October 22nd. You can make great strides in whatever you want to do today because you make such a great impression on parents, bosses, VIPs, and the police. You can sweet talk your way into or out of anything. It's also a popular day for you. Enjoy socializing, reading for amusement, concerts, art exhibits, and sports. Tonight, interesting conversations. Scorpio, October 23rd through November 21st. This is the perfect day to explore avenues in higher education, publishing, the media, medicine, the law, and anything to do with travel. Doors will open for you because you're admired, well-spoken, and convincing. You will hold people in the palm of your hand. Tonight, maintain your possessions. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. This is a five-star day for you. The moon is in your sign, dancing with lucky money bags, Jupiter. You will find the financial discussions about shared property and anything that is jointly held with someone else will favor you. Ka-ching! Tonight, you win. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. This is the perfect day to tell someone close to you how much they mean to you. Tell them that you care. People love to hear this. We all do. And yet, so many of us leave it up to the imagination of someone very close. Travel plans look appealing. Tonight, enjoy privacy. Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th. Some of you might have a crush on a coworker or a person involved with your health regime. Whatever the case, today is the day to let someone know that you care. You might also get caught up in competitive sports and athletics because it's appealing. Many exciting possibilities today. Tonight, be friendly. Pisces, lastly, February 19th through March 20th. This is such a romantic day. Enjoy the company of loved ones. Do something special for your main squeeze. You will also enjoy appreciating the arts and creative work of others. Your appreciation of beauty is heightened today. Tonight, you are admired. Apparently, there's a lot of romantic air in the energy today because 90% of these horoscopes mentioned romance. All right, I am desperately trying to find something to finish reading because it's a slow news day today. So let me see what I can try and gather that isn't sports related. hold on. I did today in history. Hang on. This doesn't sound good. Okay. Out of Madison, Wisconsin, fatal police shooting of a man with knife, a Royals community. The police shooting death of a homeless man who wounded an officer with a knife while resisting arrest has roiled Wisconsin's capital city, with protesters and community groups demanding accountability and an end to racial injustice. Corey Durrell Ruiz, 38, was shot and killed on a city street Wednesday. The moment of his death captured the bystander videos that were later posted online. The race of the officer who fired his gun has not been released by police. Ruiz is identified as Black or Latino in Wisconsin court records. It does not matter who you are or what your past is. You should not lose your life as a result of the encounter with law enforcement, Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway said during the news conference Thursday afternoon. Wisconsin court records show Ruiz has been in and out of jail over the past decade for mostly misdemeanor offenses, including disorderly conduct, drug possession, auto theft, battery, and invasion of privacy. He was also convicted of felonies, including possession of cocaine and marijuana, robbery, strangulation, resisting an officer, and causing bodily harm. He's a human being. He had a family. He has parents who loved him, who brought him home, who cared for him, Common Council President Sabrina Madison said, adding that she's struggling to understand what she's seen in videos of the shooting that have circulated on social media. My first thought is, when the officer's walking away, why isn't he walking away in cuffs? Madison said. I'm angry. There's no way around it. Frustrated residents marched, and a memorial of flowers and signs grew near the place where Ruiz died. It was just blocks from where two other police killings happened in 2015 and 2012. A group of about 20 protesters burst into Thursday's news conference, taking the microphone from Police Chief John Patterson and arguing with some attendees who said they wanted to hear more about the investigation. One protester held a sign saying corrupt cops deserve to die too. Moments earlier, the mayor said the shooting would be rigorously investigated. Once the protesters quieted down, the chief resumed the presentation, promising his department's full cooperation with the state investigation. None of the four officers who were detaining Ruiz wore body cameras, but passersby recorded the confrontation on video and accused the officers of overreacting. I thought, holy cow, what could have warranted that? It looked to me like they had him under control, David Ortiz Whitham, who saw officers swarming and heard the gunshots, said Thursday. Even now, knowing about the knife, did he have to die for it? Could this have been de-escalated? The police chief released few details Thursday, saying Wisconsin Division of Criminal Investigation probe of the officer involved shooting must run its course. Earlier Thursday, Madison's independent police monitor, Aramiku Glass, said police has not yet shared evidence of the officer's identity with her office, which will review the case and can recommend to the district attorney that charges be filed if warranted. She said the department and city are obstructing what the community and the public want. Let me do my job, she said. Patterson said the police were committed to cooperating with Glass. Patterson has urged caution in reading too much from the cell phone videos. He said none show the perspective of the officers, and additional videos that hasn't been released is being reviewed. The officer who fired his weapon, and an 11-year veteran of the force, The chief said. He and three other responding officers will be placed on administrative leave pending the investigation by Wisconsin Division of Criminal Investigation as required under state law. Patterson said police were responding to calls that someone was attempting to enter parked vehicles and the subject fled on a bike before the officer surrounded him. One deployed a taser, but Patterson said the effort failed to control the man. In the video circulating online, the man can be seen, standing before he's brought to his knees as the officer struggled to force him into a prone position. Then he falls quickly to the pavement after what sounds like three gunshots and seems motionless as the officers handcuffed him behind his back. Arriving officers then escort one of the officers a short distance away. Patterson said he did not know the extent of the knife injuries sustained by the officer. This situation was clearly dangerous, Patterson said, before adding he was saddened by the loss of life. A neighborhood now accustomed to police shootings. The shootings happened in the middle of an intersection in the popular Marquette neighborhood, less than 2 miles from the state capitol. Bystander videos show numerous cars at the scene with people watching as it unfolds. I saw everything. You did not need to kill him. We watched it all, a woman yells in the video recorded by Ortiz with him. Three loud shots can be heard among the sirens, followed by screams. Residents who dealt with two other police killings expressed frustration Thursday. In 2015, a white police officer shot and killed Tody Robinson, who was biracial, on the same street. Large protests followed, but the district attorney filed no charges, determining the officer was justified. In 2012, Paul Heenan, a white musician, was fatally shot after he had been drinking and mistakenly entered his neighbor's house. That officer was exonerated as well. The chief acknowledged that the neighborhood has experienced a lot of trauma and urged people to support one another. I want transparency. I want accountability, Patterson said. Black advocacy groups, protesters, and politicians are speaking out against the shooting, which has also focused attention on the Madison Police Department's lack of body-worn cameras. The force of around 500 is among the largest in the Midwest that doesn't use the devices. Madison said Thursday she expects a police request for $400,000 to be approved, enabling the cameras to be phased in over the next 3 years. Others lamented that cameras weren't already being used. The mayor said her budget, which has not yet been released, will include funding for body-worn cameras. She said the cities need to put together a policy for their use before the budget takes effect in January. And now it's a talking point in the governor's race. The shooting has quickly infused itself into the race to succeed Evers as governor, with voting already underway in the August 11th primary. Democratic Socialist candidate Francesca Hong called the shooting state-sanctioned violence, and Democrat Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley said the reports are painfully reminiscent of the tragedies we have witnessed in Kenosha, Minneapolis, and far too many communities. Republican U.S. Representative Tom Tiffany called his rivals to let the state investigation establish the facts without politicians rushing to judgment. This story has been corrected to show it is the Wisconsin Division of Criminal Investigation, not the Department of Criminal Investigation. All right, sad story. Let's hope it all pans out without anyone losing their jobs or injustice being served. All right, there it is, 10 minutes to 11. I have literally run out of things to read other than the sports, so I am going to close down a little bit early for today. I wish everyone a wonderful weekend. I hope the Folk Festival is crowded, fun, safe, entertaining, and I guess family-oriented would be a wonderful thing. Many families taking on the history and running with it. Enjoy everything you do this weekend. Be safe. Use sunscreen. Be happy and kind to one another. And enjoy all the summer has to offer here in Lowell. Have a great weekend, everyone.
To play a critical role in memory consolidation, emotional regulation, and learning. Over the course of the night, the brain moves through a repeating sequence from light sleep into deep, slow-wave sleep, and then into REM sleep, the phase most closely associated with vivid, emotionally charged dreams. By reducing the time spent in REM, THC may also diminish the intensity and frequency of dreaming. Some of the strongest clues came from clinicians treating patients whose dreams had become pathological. A landmark 2015 double-blind placebo-controlled study led by Rakesh Jetty, a Canadian military psychiatrist, looked at the effects of a synthetic analog of THC on returning soldiers. They suffered from severe treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder. The study showed that the right dose not only helped with hyperarousal during the day, but also quieted the former soldier's nightmares. Ryan Vandry, an experimental psychologist who helps run the Johns Hopkins Cannabis Science Laboratory, said THC exerts its effects by binding to the brain's cannabinoid receptors, which helped maintain a balance between excitatory and inhibitory neural activity. The brain's endocannabinoid system is really a system that balances arousal, he said. With chronic use, the brain adapts by reducing the number and sensitivity of these receptors. When THC use stops, the endocannabinoid system is temporarily unable to function normally, disrupting sleep regulation. While the study was small, it suggested that manipulating the brain's endocannabinoid system appeared to change not just sleep, but the content of dreams themselves. Sleep, it turns out, may have a way of settling its debts. After weeks or months of suppressed dreaming, users in studies and throughout social media who stop cannabis have described how the brain compensates with an explosive return of an unusually bizarre or emotional REM rebound. If dreams have a function, it may be to let the brain experiment safely. Some scientists have suggested it might serve as an overnight workshop that allows us to simulate threats, rehearse social encounters, strengthen memories, and process emotionally charged experiences before waking returns us to the real world. Just how harmful is it to stop dreaming? Matthew Hill, a neuroscientist at the University of Calgary, who studies the intersection of cannabinoids, stress, and sleep, believes there are reasons to think the loss of dreaming is not entirely benign. Some of the strongest evidence comes from people with cannabis use disorder, a medical condition marked by compulsive cannabis use. Hill said that disrupted sleep is among the most common and persistent symptoms these individuals experience. Evidence linking occasional cannabis use to dementia is inconclusive for now, but a 2025 study of more than 6 million adults published in JAMA Neurology found that cannabis use that is severe enough to require hospitalization or emergency care is linked to a 72% higher risk of a new dementia diagnosis in the following 5 years. One of the biggest challenges of quitting cannabis is what happens to sleep. When some people stop using it, they first experience insomnia, followed by a rebound in REM sleep that can trigger unusually vivid or even terrifying dreams. For some, those nightmares become so distressing that they drive a return to cannabis, creating a cycle in which the drug both suppresses dreaming and becomes the only reliable way to escape its rebound. I have talked to people in recovery who have really violent nightmares, and that's a factor for relapse, Hill said. I think the impact on sleep is considerable and scales up with potency. But the question of why we dream has never belonged to science alone. It encompasses neuroscience, philosophy, and spirituality. Mitchell's dreams have become less intense with time, but they still occur with regularity. He has no intention of using cannabis again, he said, because he does not want to lose the ability to dream once more. Mitchell believes that dreaming fuels his creativity. He continues to experiment with vegan recipes, stuffed green tomatoes, jackfruit birria tacos, sharing them online, and enjoys creating and playing music. He said he has come to see cannabis as stifling his creativity. Some people say it enhances it, he said. I feel like it slows you down. But even more important, dreaming connects him to those he has lost. Years ago, his cousin, who was also his closest friend and roommate, died at 43 of cancer that had spread to his throat. Mitchell keeps his ashes at home. In dreams, however, their conversations continue. Having dreams is very important, he said. They connect you to different timelines in life. They give you hints and signs of the future, and they can give you closure. That concludes this Friday's reading of the Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.
You were just listening to the Washington Post on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, sunny, temperatures in the mid-80s. Clear overnight, temperatures in the lower 60s. Saturday, sunny, temperatures in the lower 80s. The sun rose this morning at 5:30, setting at 8:12 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
This is the Chef of Love, Chef Gennard, TV host and restaurateur. My grandparents harvested their land to sell food and shared its overflowing bounty with our community. Grandma said, for every yam we pick, we give one away. In the world they cultivated, I love preparing and eating dinner with my family on Sundays. When our resources changed, food assistance programs sustained us. They gave me fuel to start my first culinary business at 16 years old, and inspiration to donate the extra food in my community. Through my life, I've developed an appetite to work with others to ensure everyone has access to the nutritious food we need to thrive. Together, we can help end hunger. Come on, join the movement with Feeding America by volunteering, donating, and advocating. Learn more at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
The Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council present the story of Cynthia and Ed.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, out of the blue, she stopped at the stop sign.